Okay, today's shiur is going to be about something, an issue which is very divisive and explosive in the general public. It's about the abortion controversy, and this topic has come up again a few weeks ago from a different approach, when the pro-life camp tried to change the definition of personhood, and thereby to cause difficulties in doing abortions. And let's take a look at the Initiative 26, which would amend the Mississippi Constitution to define the word person or persons, as those terms are used in Article 3 of the State Constitution, to include every human being from the moment of fertilization, cloning, or functional equivalent thereof. And this was the initiative which was presented to the voters a few weeks ago, beginning of November. And I quote from various media, since it's tied to fertilization, it implicates all sorts of other things, like many methods of hormonal birth control, like preventing implantation after fertilization has occurred, or fertility treatments where embryos are at risk. That's Dr. Will, assistant professor of law in the University of Mississippi. Even more serious, is the most salient is its potential to prohibit women from seeking abortions as medical care in instances in which the life of the mother is threatened. Ectopic pregnancies, for example. The ambiguous wording of Initiative 26 seems to allow no exceptions for the life of the mother. This is all describing Initiative 26 in Mississippi. The Personhood Initiative Group, in their Mississippi Personhood booklet, makes its stance clear. A life of the mother exception to any abortion law would be a violation of the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment, because other classes of people are not given that same kind of exception. And the measure would prevent doctors from terminating ectopic pregnancies, which could have fatal consequences. Basically, there would be no life of the mother exceptions, and women needing that care can either flee to other states or chas v'shalom die. What about chemotherapy? Opponents say that that measure could have criminalized birth control, affected in vitro fertilization practices, and even forced doctors to decline to provide pregnant cancer patients with chemotherapy for fear of legal repercussions. Maybe these were scare tactics, but there's a lot of truth in them. And on Tuesday, November 8th, the Mississippi Personhood Amendment, which could have amended the Mississippi Constitution to define the word person or persons to include every human being from the moment of fertilization, was defeated at the polls by a 58-42% margin, which was a big surprise because the prediction was that it is going to pass. Now, when we take a look at the definition of personhood, their biology offers a number of stages in the life cycle that have been seen as candidates for personhood. Fertilization, implantation, which takes place a few days after fertilization, segmentation, after twinning is no longer possible, when the heart begins to beat, neuromaturation, neonatal perception, fetal viability, or birth. So all these stages might be seen at the beginning when the fetus might be considered a person with all the rights that are entitled for a living person. But it seems that all agree that there are only two values, a non-person and a person. And that the moment personhood is attained, that person has all the rights of a mature human being, including the right to life even at the expense of the mother's life. What does the Jewish religion have to say on the subject? And of course, this amendment, if it would have been enacted, would have impacted also the Jewish population that also have these problems. So the issues we want to address tonight is, at what stage does the conceptus achieve the status of a human being? Are its rights at that stage the same as the mother's rights? Is there a difference if the zygote is in the body or in the lab? Meaning, if the embryo is still not transferred to the body of the female, is it also considered life? Are fertilized eggs in the lab, which are produced in IVF, are they considered human beings? And also, what about disposal of unneeded defective embryos? Should we be mechalal Shabbos to save frozen embryos? Embryos, when they're produced in the lab, can be frozen, and they can be kept for many years frozen. But what happens if there's a blackout? And if they are considered persons or living beings, just we know pikuach nefesh is doicha Shabbos, can we be mechalal Shabbos to save those embryos? Is it necessary for parents, for the couple to pay forever for storing frozen embryos? This shaila comes up too. It costs money to store these embryos. And what happens when the couple does not plan to have more children? Do they have to keep on paying for those embryos? May unneeded embryos be discarded or destroyed? So let's take a look at our eternal sources. In Chazal, when is the beginning of life? The Gemara says in Sanhedrin, Tzadik Aleph Amud Beis, Vomeloi Antoninus the Rebbe. Antoninus was a Roman king, and he was very close to Rebbe. Rebbe was the Rabbeinu HaKodesh, the Mesadr of the Mishnah, Rebbe Anosi, and they had a lot of discourses together, and which are recorded in Chazal. And this is a very interesting discussion they had. Antoninus asked Rebbe, Nishoma me'aymesai nitnu bu'udam. When is the stage when a person gets his soul, the neshoma? Mishas pekida or mishas yitzira? Mishas yitzira is when the fetus is fully developed. Pekida is when HaKadosh Baruch Hu decides on the tippa to become a human being, to start developing. Umar loy, so Rebbe answered mishas yitzira. That's towards the end of the pregnancy. Umar loy, so Antoninus asks, Efshar chaticha shel busar medes loy sheyumen b'loy melach. Can you leave a piece of meat without refrigeration, without salt? 3 days. V'ayno masachas, and it shouldn't spoil. Elu, it cannot be that the fetus from the beginning until the last stage of the pregnancy does not have an neshama. It's not possible. Otherwise, it would spoil. Elu mishas pekida. The soul enters the conceptus mamish at the beginning. Umarevi dovrzei limdani Antoninus. I admit that this very important fact I learned from Antoninus. In mikru misayoi. And lo and behold, I found a pusik that supports his approach. Shneima if kudoshu shomru ruchi. Kudoshu is from bishas pekida. At the first moment, that's when HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave him a ruach, a neshama. And let's take a look how Rashi explains this whole discussion. Mishas Yitzira, Rashi says, what is the stage which is called Yitzira? Shenikrem kuloi bebusor vegidin v'atzumois. When the body of the fetus is fully formed, as the flesh, the gidin, which are the arteries or maybe the ligaments, the atzumos in the bones. Pekida is when Meshusha Malach poiked a tippa, when the Malach takes the droplet, and he asks Kodesh Baruch Hu, what is going to happen with this? Miyab Nizriku by Neshuma the Chayus. Immediately the child gets a Neshuma and he gets viability. Now, it's not clear what Rashi meant, poiked a tippa. The tippa can mean the sperm, the oocyte, or maybe the embryo after fertilization, or maybe it's even before fertilization, or maybe it's only after the implantation. So this is not clear. Umaloy Antoninus, v'chi efshe lechaticha sh'teskayim v'lishloish yimim v'loy melach sh'ayinu masrachas. Just as you understand that a piece of meat which is not refrigerated cannot be fresh and not spoil without salt, huchanami ilu loyhoisu neshuma nesunu. If not, the neshuma would be given at shas yitzira. Haich tiskayim atipesh loy tasriach b'mayehu. How is it possible that this tippah should not spoil? The kinesh tippah mesachas, and as soon as the tippah, as the droplet spoils, shuv ayno moiledes. So it cannot be fertile. Limdani Antoninus admitted Rabbi midvur of lamadati, and the pasuk also supports his approach. Uf kudosku shamru ruchi mishas pekida nishmar ruchi. So we see from this Gemara that a conceptus is considered alive from the very beginning. But we still don't know exactly when that beginning is. Pekida, the translation is probably conception. Now when you take a look at two dictionaries, what is the definition of conception? In Webster's dictionary, it says the conception means the act of conceiving in the womb. And that's probably implantation. In the Cambridge Advanced Dictionary, the process of a sperm and an egg joining and causing a baby to start to form. And that's fertilization. So we see here that even the secular definition of conception is not clear. Is it fertilization when the embryo starts to developing, or is it implantation when the embryo implants and attaches to the endometrium and it starts developing and growing into a viable fetus? As we see here on the left, the distal part of the fallopian tube, that's where ovulation happens. The oocyte meets the sperm, and then it starts traveling through the fallopian tube. On the top, we have the first cleavage. Day 4, it develops more. PGD is done when it reaches the 8-cell stage. And then day 6, it's an early blastocyst. And day 7 is when it probably implants. So we have here a window between fertilization and implantation, even in the body. And of course, when it's done in the lab, when IVF is done, the fertilization happens in the lab, and then the embryo is transferred to the woman, and also it takes some time until the implantation occurs. So when is that pekida, shas pekida, the moment of conception when this embryo is considered alive? And let's go for a moment and talk about what happens when there's a danger to the life of the mother. Can we sacrifice the pregnancy, the fetus, to save the mother? The Mishnah says in the Maseches Ha'olos, Perek Zayin, Mishnah Vov, Hu ishu shi makashu lailit, a woman that's in childbirth and there's a danger developing, we're allowed to sacrifice the child. We can even cut him up and take him out piecewise. Her life comes before his life. You too, Ruboy. But if the child is already out of the birth canal, Rov, part of the body is already born. And here's the English explanation. The Talmud holds that a fetus's life is less valuable than a woman's. If the woman's life is endangered by the pregnancy, it requires an abortion. However, if the greater part of the fetus has emerged, then its life may not be taken even to save the mother's, because you cannot choose between one human life and another. So we see a clear distinction between the life of a fetus and the life of the mother. Although the fetus is alive from the moment of conception, nevertheless the value of his life is of a lower status than that of the mother. Because when you have to weigh one life against the other, we look at the life of the fetus with a lower value than of the mother, and therefore we are allowed to sacrifice the child to save the mother. What about Chilul Shabbos to save a fetus? We're not talking about the danger to the mother. There's only a danger to the fetus. Is the fetus, as we're explaining now, is that the value of the life of the fetus is of a lesser value than that of the mother. But is it sufficient to allow Chilul Shabbos to save the fetus? Is he considered a human being at least for that, that we have to be mechallel Shabbos to save the fetus when there's no danger to the mother? The Bir Halacha, Mishnah Brura in Simen Shin Lamed, Sif Zion writes, he brings down from Bahag, Baal Halachas Gedolos, Shagam Bevlat Koidem Mem Yom, a fetus which is not yet old, 40 days, the Maya Ba'almu, although he's considered Maya Ba'almu for certain halachas, Afal Pekain Mechallelin, we're supposed to be Mechallel Shabbos to save that fetus. And Shabbos Shuva Shevet Alevi writes, he brings down from the Ramban, Afaluch Alinyan Shmiras HaMitzvahs Mechallelin Ulav Amru Toira, we're supposed to be Mechallel Shabbos for that Uber, for the fetus. The Torah says, Chalal Ulav Shabbos Achas, we're supposed to be Mechallel one Shabbos, Shemu Yishmor Shabbosas Harve, in order that the child should be able to shoyme many Shabbosim. Chol Kachafilu Batzulis Uber Puchas Vemem Yoyim. Sha'ayim Boi Chayas Klal, he doesn't really have Chayas yet. Mechallelin Kadas Malaluchas. So the Ramban also holds the same way, that there is a Heter to be Mechallel Shabbos for a fetus. And the Bir Halacha adds, Hina Svuris Bag Dini Del Inyan Harigas HaHoyrig. Although there's no capital punishment for a person who kills a fetus, and we see the value of his life is lesser than of that of a complete human being because we can sacrifice him to save the mother. Nevertheless, so we see that the value of a child is enough, the life of a child, of a fetus is enough to be Mechallel Shabbos. And what about a fetus before the transfer? When the fetus is still, an embryo which is still in the lab. So here we have Shalosh Shuvot Shevet Halevi, Chelik Yud Simon Reish Lamed Aleph, he writes, Avgam Eilu Shesavrim Kanal. Even those poskim that agree that for a fetus, even before in the 40 days, beyoyis hikvar meuveres veuni matzilim chayei uber, sheused lios nefesh chay, we're supposed to be mechallel Shabbos. Avel loykain behazruas chutz. This does not apply when we're dealing with IVF. V'chiyal le'aladas, can even someone envision duvar hevel kazei, such a nonsense? Shehai muter lechallel Shabbos al zera zeh shebechutz adayin, which is still in the lab, pshita deloy. There's no question that you're not allowed to be mechallel Shabbos. Vashkususoy ve'ibudoy, and to destroy him or to discard, nechnes begeder chumres hashkus al zera shechumr mo'od, v'hanudon rak im halucha materes hashkus al zera zeh alo. So the way he looks at it is that as long as the embryo or the gamete, the sperm and the oocyte are still in the lab, there's no hetter to be mechallel Shabbos because it's not considered alive yet. The only din would be of hashchus zera. There's a nisa to destroy seed, which is sperm, but that has nothing to do with chilul Shabbos. It's not alive yet. So according to his understanding, fertilization, which is done in the lab, although we're dealing with an embryo, this embryo is not alive. And therefore, there's no heter to be mechallel Shabbos for it. So we've clarified at least one step. In the lab, in vitro, when there is an embryo, this is not a living human being. So let's go ahead. What about disposal of unneeded defective embryos? What is the conclusion? There's no obligation to pay for unneeded or defective embryos because they're not alive, and to go ahead and pay every year when there's a final decision that these embryos will not be used by the couple, there's no obligation to pay for it. Although they're not considered alive, nevertheless, they should not be destroyed directly as Hashchus HaZera might apply. They can be removed from the freezing tank and left to spoil. They should not be donated for use either for fertility purposes or for research. And the reason for that is that we are very, very, the halacha is very concerned about unclear maternity or paternity identity. We have to know, every child has to know whose father and mother are, and therefore many poskim disallow donation of sperm and oocytes. So therefore, if this embryo will be donated to someone else to use it, this will cause chashash of mamzerus and other problems. And research is the same, because since there is an issue of hashchos zera, there's no heter to use zera or to use embryos for research.
What about non-Jewish, where there's no chashash for mamzerus?
So please explain, what do you mean non-Jews? The couple that wants the embryo is non-Jewish?
Yeah. No, the opposite. Where the couple's embryo is non-Jewish. They're not Jews. So I guess
there's no problem. Because by non-Jews, there's no problem of Yichus. Now this whole discussion is also related to the IUD controversy. What is an IUD? It's an intrauterine device, which is one of the types of contraception. And I'll show you in a moment how it looks. While experts aren't exactly sure how, it's suspected that the IUD alters the movement of an egg or sperm, making conception difficult. When this device is in the uterus, conception doesn't happen. IUDs that contain hormones also work by thickening a woman's cervical mucus, thereby creating a natural barrier to sperm, so the sperm can't penetrate through the cervix. As well, the hormones help to alter the uterine lining in order to inhibit implantation of a fertilized egg. Is use of an IUD considered abortion? That's the question. And that was the question, basically, which was raised and when this initiative came up. Are IUDs considered abortion? Because, as we explain now, there are various ways with how the IUD achieves the contraception, or by incapacitating the sperm or the egg, or by preventing implantation, where we're dealing already with an embryo in vivo in the body. These are various types of IUD, intrauterine device. This is the copper one. You see on the base of the IUD, there's a coil of copper coiled around the base. And here's the Mirena IUDs, which have hormones. On the left is the Mirena IUD, and these release hormones into the uterus, into the cavity of the uterus, which has this effect of thinning and preventing implantation. Now, the Mirena IUD has a few effects. One, it causes thinning of the lining of the uterus, which prevents implantation. Inhibition of sperm movement, which prevents fertilization, and also thickening of the cervical mucus, also for the same purpose, to prevent fertilization, preventing the sperm reaching the fallopian tubes. So is IUD abortion? Most poskim do not consider IUDs as abortion for several reasons. Most probably because it only prevents fertilization. Even if it also inhibits implantation, it's only passively. It's not destroying directly the embryo. It's only changing the environment within the uterus, and therefore the embryo cannot implant or attach to the uterine lining. So this is not a direct attack on the embryo. Even those few that do consider it a form of abortion, and there are some poskim, but it's not, it's das yuchid, we do have some gedolim that are uncomfortable with allowing IUDs, they would differentiate between an in vitro embryo, which is in a non-viable state and therefore not alive, and an embryo in vivo, which can eventually implant and develop normally. So let me explain what I'm driving at. I'm trying to understand the status of an embryo before implantation. And we showed before that as long as the embryo is in the lab, it's definitely not alive. Well, what happens with that embryo after fertilization, before it implants in the body? Those 4-7 days from fertilization, while the embryo is going through the fallopian tube and until it reaches the uterine cavity, we have about 7 days. So if an IUD is in place, it prevents that embryo from developing, implanting and developing. We are basically destroying that embryo. Is the embryo before implantation alive when it's in the body, here we have a difference of opinion. Some poskim can feel that it's not alive, because as long as it's not implanted, it's not a living human being, and therefore IUDs are no problem. Or others feel there is a problem because it's already in a natural environment which could develop into a human being, and therefore IUDs should not be used.
So an embryo in a petri dish can change its status simply by putting it into the uterus.
Correct.
A minute later, you take that embryo and
yes. According to those poskim, they do not allow IUD. The moment the embryo is in the environment which it can develop into a viable fetus, then you're not allowed to destroy it.
So the location determines the viability.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. That's the explanation that I think is the only way we can understand it. but since the general opinion is that IUDs are not a child of abortion, so that we do not look at preventing implantation as if abortion, so the embryo is not alive yet. So if we want to summarize and see how the Torah looks at this whole picture, we have a value-based system, not a one or two or person or non-person. We have various values. We have a value-based system where a different value of life is assigned to various late stages of fetal development. These are measured by the heter of Chilul Shabbos, to say from Sukkuna. Number one, the embryo in vitro, no Chilul Shabbos, it's not alive. The embryo in vivo, when it's already in the body, before implantation, depends on the IUI controversy, and most poskim do not consider that alive yet, so therefore, anything that is done to prevent implantation is allowed. Embryo after implantation for a fetus, we're supposed to be Mechal Shabbos to save it, because there is already a din of life on that fetus, but it can be sacrificed to save the mother. At birth, it's a full-fledged human being equal to the mother. I think also it's very morally understandable, this approach, than the black and white approach which the others have.
You too, on this last point, the location makes a big difference, because the baby, 5 minutes before it's born, is in one location and is still considered that you can abort it if you have to.
Yes.
And 2 minutes later when it's in another
location. Maybe it's not only the location, maybe some physiological changes happen in that moment when the child emerges from the birth canal. The child starts breathing.
No, but it does start breathing though, if its head is partly out, then it would not be allowed to save the mother.
Right.
So breathing wouldn't be the factor.
Oh, but probably other things happen.
Sometimes it could, but often doesn't. Even if the baby's not breathing, you would not be allowed to save the mother.
Right. But I assume that other physiological changes happen in the body when the child emerges from the...
The category three is enormous. You're talking about implantation all the way, it's the entire pregnancy.
Mm-hmm.
So according to this, you can't really do anything, right? Implantation is...
Unless there's a danger to the mother. Sure. Or the fetus is not viable.
If the fetus is, number three, if the fetus is in danger but not the mother, are you allowed to the fellow Shabbos?
Absolutely.
Right.
Absolutely.
So how does it do with the mother?
What do you think comes to me? When we talk about the discussion of abortion.
Now you asked me previously about 40 days. 40 days is a big machlokes of poskim, and the accepted the conclusion is that before 40 days is not allowed to do an abortion per se, but if an abortion has to be done anyway because it's a dangerous situation, we should prefer doing it before the 40 days because then it's a lesser of an iser. But of course, we're not in danger, we can't do it.
What is that? What's that 40 days?
The 40 days is a breakup point which is mentioned in the Chazal, that until 40, the Chazal say that at 40 days or 42 days, that the child starts to form, to develop. Therefore, for instance, if a woman had a miscarriage after 40 days, the coming child Sputa from Pidyon HaBen, because it's really considered that she had a child. The 440 days, not. Because 440 days, it's still not formed at all. So there is a break-off point, 40 days. So some, and this is a lesson of Chazal, that Ad Mem Yom Kemaya Ba'alma, it's like water.
But it still has life.
It has life, of course. The Chazal mentioned that in regard to a different halakha completely, of Legab Achilas Truma. So it's something which unrelated to the Shala of life or not. But since that was mentioned in Chazal, some feel that it's a turning point about when it comes to abortions. A moment about the morning after pill, which is also related to this discussion. Mifepristone is a synthetic steroid compound used as a pharmaceutical. It's used as an abortifacient in the first 2 months of pregnancy. It's also sometimes used as an emergency contraceptive, the so-called morning after pill. Before implantation has occurred, it can be compared to an IUD and permitted. After implantation, it's clearly an abortifacient and halachically forbidden. So that's an important window we have when something happened and...
42 days.
Again, 42 days is...
If she takes the pill, let's say on day 30.
That's an abortion.
Just to clarify, there's two types of pills.
Mm-hmm.
Morning after pill is not the mifepristone. Mifepristone is the person's actually pregnant.
Mm-hmm.
And you give this drug and it turns off all progesterone and then they miscarry.
Mm-hmm.
Morning after pill is a high dose of progesterone.
Progesterone.
And that
prevents implantation.
Right.
So what I'm saying is that this pill to prevent implantation is like the IUD, which you're allowed to do.
So that I understand. But my point being is that if the fetus is not considered to be viable or not considered to be a human being or partial human being or whatever until day 42, is the woman allowed to take the mifepristone at day 20 or day 25.
Okay, this depends on this shaila of 40 days. And as I explained before, the Trump 40 days before 40 days is not a heter to do abortions. It's whenever an abortion has to be done because of medical reasons, we advise to do it before the 40 days. But
for medical reasons, you can do it even after 40 days.
Exactly.
So 40 days doesn't matter.
It matters that we have to prefer doing it before the 40 days because then it's a lesser of an iser. Because some place can feel that it's a heter. But we cannot allow using this mifepristone after implantation. Yes?
But just to clarify, so the morning after pill, according to what you said before, would only be up to about 7 days
right.
After implantation.
Right. So as Dr. Avinayim explained, the morning after pill is a high dose of progesterone, which won't do anything after the implantation. It's only good before implantation. Okay, let's talk now about abortion for medical reasons when the mother's life is endangered. What is the iser of hapulas ubrim? Nechliku apoiskem im iser hapulas ubrim hu iser toira or iser drabonon. And just briefly to list the various shittas, betam hu iser, what is the basis of the iser to do an abortion? Aleph, what some parts can feel it's a din in Ritzicha, Aval Einul of Einish Misa. There's no capital punishment, but it's a part of Isser Ritzicha, of murder. Beis, Medin Hashchus Zera. It's a Kalvachomer. If there's an Isser to destroy seed, sperm, it's a Kalvachomer. You're not allowed to destroy an embryo or a fetus. Gimel Mishim Choyvel, or Mazik Behuam, it's a Torah of Choyvel. Dalet Medin Gzayle. We're stealing away from him his life. Right, his life. We're taking away his life. This is the most precious possession of a person, is a life. His life. And we're taking that away. So this Mishnah we saw before, this is the Mishnah, the source of the halucha that whenever the mother's life is in danger, an abortion can be done. And this is in English, we saw that before. And what is the heter? Why are we allowing an abortion when the mother's life is in danger? The Gemara says, Yotza roish ayin nogem boi lefish ayin doichem nefesh mipnai nefesh. Vamai roidev hu. Shanus and the Mishmaya Kurat Falai. This Rashi explains. during the whole pregnancy, lav nefesh hu. His life is not considered nefesh. V'nitin lahorgo lahatzilas imoy. As we explained before, this is the reason for that is that the value of his life is of a lesser value than that of the mother. The Rambam has another explanation. Rambam writes, "Alayz mitzvus loyzus shloi luchus al nefesh haroidef. Lefincha choyru chachumen shehu ubru shehi makashu lailed. The pregnant woman that is having difficulty giving birth, muter lachtachu uber b'mayehu b'ayim b'san b'ayim b'yad m'tay shehu k'roidef achreyu lahalga. Because the fetus is threatening to kill the mother. So that whenever Reuben threatens to kill Shimon, we're allowed to kill Reuben. So we see here two different explanations. Rashi's explanation is that the child is not considered nefesh. The Rambam does not suffice with that. The Rambam needs a stronger argument why we're allowed to kill the child, because he's threatening to kill the mother. Rav Kiva Eiger writes, he tomua on the Rambam. So Rav Kivaga doesn't understand why the Rambam had to add that argument. We already have a very simple argument. The child's life is less value than the mother's. There's a big nafkamin al halucha. Here we're going a bit into lambdas. What is the nafkamin al halucha between the approach of the Rambam and the approach of Rashi? The nafkamin would be, what happens when the child, the fetus, is not directly threatening the mother. The mother has a certain medical condition, and the only way to save her is by sacrificing the child. But he's not threatening directly. According to the Rashi, that his life is of a lesser value, when we have to save the life of the mother, we can sacrifice the child. But according to the Rambam, that he's allowed to be terminated because he's directly threatening the mother. It's only when he does it, when the threat is directly related to the fetus. But if it's indirectly, there shouldn't be a threat.
In both cases, the child is threatening the mother. If she has a medical condition that will kill her unless she has an abortion, unless she ends the pregnancy, then it's because the...
Okay, so let me show you a case where it's not directly threatening. Let's talk about a molar pregnancy. A molar pregnancy is an abnormal form of pregnancy wherein a non-viable fertilized egg implants in the uterus and thereby converts normal pregnancy processes into pathological ones. It's categorized by the presence of a hydatidiform mole. And these moles can develop into choriocarcinoma, a form of cancer. And this is how it looks when it fills the uterus. An early placenta, which developed into abnormal cysts, and this becomes a malignant tissue.
This falls under pregnancy, but in terms of a baby,
we're not finished yet. Now, what happens when there's a coexisting live twin? In rare cases, the hydatidiform mole coexists in the uterus with a normal viable fetus. These cases are due to twinning. The uterus contains two conceptuses, one with an abnormal placenta and no viable fetus, the mole, and one with a normal placenta and a viable fetus. Most such pregnancy will be terminated prematurely either because of persisting hemorrhage or severe preeclampsia. However, the risk of developing persistent gestational trophoblastic tumor should be kept in mind. Here we have a picture of that. On the left of the M is the molar, and then on the right we have the living fetus. What is the treatment? It should be treated by evacuating the uterus by uterine suction or by surgical curettage as soon as possible after diagnosis in order to avoid risks of choriocarcinoma. Halachically, is it a basis for allowing abortion? It can be argued that the mole is the cause of danger and thus the roidif and not the fetus. So maybe this would depend on the two explanations. According to the Rambam, the only heter to kill a fetus is when that fetus is threatening the mother. Here the fetus is not...
They're both threatening the mother.
Why is the fetus, the living fetus, threatening the mother?
Because if...
The cancer is threatening the mother.
No, right. But I mean, the mole is threatening the mother. But if you want to leave the fetus, okay, to save the fetus, you're by leaving the fetus, you're now threatening the mother. because mother needs to have that more.
Okay. And basically, that's my conclusion too. But I agree with you. But from a Lambda's point of view, it would depend on this machloikas. Because the Rambam, when he went ahead and said that the reason why we allow an abortion is because that pregnancy, that fetus is threatening the mother. Here, this fetus is a normal fetus. He has a twin which is threatening the mother. Why should we sacrifice the mother? But when you look at it from Rashi's perspective, then we have a different value of life. The child, the fetus, has a lower value. Yes?
And how did we answer the problem that he raised on the Rambam that he's still a relative when he's born? Wasn't that a problem?
Well, could I ask that he had no answer for it? Yes.
Because he's still a relative, no?
Including when he's born.
No, because we said the Rambam says he's the reason you can abort is because he's threatening the mother as a relative, as if Reuven is about to kill Shimon. But if he's already mostly born, then you can't.
Right. So can I ask? He's still a rabbi.
He's still threatening the mother, and you can still kill Reuven when he's about to kill.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't have an answer to that.
Oh, there's no answer.
So the Meskuna. Rav Paskim Naftu La'Alucha She'ikaratam Hu Karashi. Rav Rambam Moedel Zay. Even the Rambam is also Moedel to Rashi. The Kan She'i Hafshar Lusar Asakuna Shu Asandel. You cannot remove the mold without killing the living fetus. Yeshlam Shenachshav Gamhu Uber Keroidu, exactly as Dr. Portnoy said. Al Kan Muta La'Apol Shnayim Kedai LaHatzila. So even in this case, when the living twin, the living fetus, is no direct danger to the mother, but since we can't save the life of the mother without removing the whole pregnancy, it is considered as roidah, even according to Rambam, and of course according to Rashi, and this is allowed. Now, a few moments about various medical conditions which might cause danger to the mother and therefore allow abortions. Maternal indications for induced abortion. Preeclampsia or toxemia, which is pregnancy-induced hypertension, pulmonary hypertension, cardiac malformations such as Marfan syndrome, molar pregnancy, which you just mentioned.
What is the reason for the abortion in Marfan?
Because there's a 50% mortality if we leave the pregnancy.
In the mother? The mother has Marfan.
Yes, the mother. Okay. These are maternal indications. All these conditions are the endanger the mother when there is this condition. Cervical cancer, and a patient under 20 weeks should have hysterectomy or radiation for the cancer, and therefore the pregnancy has to be terminated. Gestational diabetes and renal failure. Let's take a look at these last two because these are, it's not that clear. Gestational diabetes is a condition in which women without previously diagnosed diabetes exhibit high blood glucose levels during pregnancy.
By the way, it's just a question. Are you talking about induced abortion or induction of labor?
The pregnancy has to be terminated to save the mother. If you can save the child too, why not?
Okay, because those gestational diabetes, the mom's not going to die.
That's why I want to talk about this now. First, let's explain what this condition is. Gestational diabetes generally has few symptoms and it is most commonly diagnosed by screening during pregnancy. Diagnostic tests detect inappropriately high levels of glucose in blood samples, and gestational diabetes affects 3 to 10% of pregnancies, depending on the population studied. No specific cause has been identified, but it's believed that the hormones produced during pregnancy increase the woman's resistance to insulin, resulting in impaired glucose tolerance. Gestational diabetes is a treatable condition, and women who have adequate control of glucose levels can effectively decrease these risks. GDM poses a risk to the mother and child. This risk is largely related to high blood glucose levels and its consequences. The risk increases with higher blood glucose levels. Treatment resulting in better control of these levels can reduce some of the risks of GDM considerably. Kidney disease and pregnancy. Having kidney disease can make pregnancy more complicated. The more severe a kidney disease, the greater the risk of having a difficult pregnancy. By risks, we mean risk to the baby and risk to the mother. For most people with mild kidney disease, the risks may still be pretty low, even though they are higher than for someone with normal kidneys. For some people, usually those with quite significant kidney disease or with other health problems, the risks may occasionally be very high. As the kidney function worsens, the patient will have higher blood pressure. The more protein in the urine, the higher the risk. The risks include the fact that preeclampsia is more likely, the risk that the kidneys may suffer further damage during pregnancy, and the risk to the baby. So, should we allow a pregnancy? Should we allow abortion in such a situation? Here I quote from my dear friend. Kidney failure or dialysis is not something that I would do an abortion for, nor is it any form of diabetes. These conditions can result in a worsening of the disease. However, it's not life threatening. Did you change your mind since then?
The abortion, you know, when you think of abortion for diabetes or for preeclampsia, it's usually at a stage in pregnancy that the baby's viable. So when we say terminate the pregnancy, we mean deliver the baby.
Mm-hmm.
And for gestational diabetes, we deliver them purely for the baby. Nothing to do with the mother, because there's no consequences to the mother to be... to have gestational diabetes,
then it's not an issue.
No, I know.
Yeah, I mean, so there's no, but I did the quote that there are risks, higher risks for the mother.
But we end the pregnancy because there's really risks to the baby.
Mm-hmm.
The baby's exposed to high sugar levels.
They both have this
very big,
mm-hmm.
and we have, there's more stillbirths, there's more problems, but purely baby.
Mm-hmm.
I think preeclampsia may be a little bit different because the mother can get sick. But it's all at a stage where the baby's completely viable and it's safe to deliver the baby.
Wonderful. So these two last, and same would apply to kidney disease?
Kidney disease is a different, I mean, here the person who's on dialysis, usually it's very hard to get them pregnant. They don't get pregnant. If they do get pregnant, it's for sure a high risk. If they have zero kidney function...
We had a few cases with which we followed together, and Baruch Hashem, they gave birth to healthy children. And that's when you wrote me this this passage that you don't... Yeah, you wrote it. Okay, now I want to finish our talk today with a real-life case. It's a very provocative case. A real-life case. A 30-year-old married Jewish woman is brought into the hospital by ambulance, drifting in and out of consciousness, near the end of second month of pregnancy. She has been unable to hold down any food or drink for days or weeks. Condition due to hyperemesis, meaning that she throws up constantly, she can't keep any food down, and was stabilized by the help of IV. IV ceased to work and was restarted twice in different places. Now unable to start another IV, the doctor advises that to keep her condition stable, he would need to have a portacath or equivalent surgically inserted. The doctor also points out that in light of her poor condition and history of hyperemesis and other complications in two prior pregnancies, he feels that's a real danger to her life, but may be able to carry the pregnancy safely if she spends the rest of the 9 months in bed with constant IV support. The patient asks the doctor to terminate the pregnancy, pointing out that she has two young children, 3 and 6, to take care of, and her husband in his late 40s is recovering from heart bypass surgery and barely has the energy to get to work and back, and certainly cannot help out. Therefore, it's not even feasible for her to have the proper care and bed rest. The husband says, "I will not even consider ending the pregnancy. I discussed the case with the rabbi, and he says she's just a complainer. Lots of women spend most of the pregnancy in bed. There's no justification to end the pregnancy. If the doctor does this without my permission, heads will roll, and I will make a lot of trouble." The doctor says, "I'll not do anything without the agreement of both wife and husband." Sounds familiar? These things happen. And the rabbi, the patient says to me, "Rabbi, why do I have to endanger my life? I force myself to eat because they cannot even find a place to put in an IV. Why? I have already 2 children. I risk my life for them. I don't want to do anything wrong, but I cannot go on." Evidently, this is a power struggle between the husband and wife, and it should be the role of the rabbi to help the couple work out their struggle and decide what is best for the family. The issue at hand is if there's a real danger to the mother or it's only a perceived one. Obviously, the couple's emotions are clouding their decision-making capacity. An expert in the field should be consulted to assess the real danger and act accordingly. Let's hear your opinion on this last case.
So the IV is not an issue because nowadays, I mean, we put in the pick line.
Okay, turn on the light, yes.
Is very safe and very functional. The real issue here is not safe for both the mother and the baby to be supported with an IV for the pregnancy.
And stay in bed.
CPN. I think, it's hard to say for sure. I don't, in our algorithm of treating hyperemesis, termination of pregnancy is really never even brought up as an option. We've got a whole line of different things that we can offer. So to hear this, it's a little unusual. People terminate for a million reasons, and there's more terminations in Quebec than there are live births. So this is really not one that would happen. I can't think of.
We had a case like this. Well, first of all, I have never seen a case where it was an unwanted. Like, it's usually, I've seen a case where the mother is like, desperate to have a child.
Mm-hmm.
So that this patient that I know ended up exactly like this, staying in hospital for the entire pregnancy with total parenteral nutrition, mm-hmm. et cetera. But eventually she lost the pregnancy mm-hmm. and she miscarried.
But here we have a fight between husband and wife, and
sending the counsel or something. I mean, this is not.
So the question is, though, halakhically, can somebody claim that quality of life, like having to stay, is that really a danger to her life or not?
Not really, no.
When you're presenting the case, I said to myself, the solution here is to get the CLC.
Exactly. Or the Bikur Chaylim to intervene. Right.
I think the question also has to be asked, when we talk about risk to life, there's magnitudes of risk. I mean, to a certain extent, all pregnancies put a mother's life at risk.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly a pregnant woman's risk of dying is higher than a non-pregnant woman.
Mm-hmm.
In this particular case, just having an intravenous actually puts her at higher risk of dying. It's not a huge increased risk, but it's an increased risk. She has a risk of getting sepsis. She has a risk of having, disease from the TPN. So the question then becomes, is any increase above a normal pregnancy considered an adequate risk? Or is it, when does it become a risk that's high enough to consider?
Okay, this is a whole different discussion, but just in a nutshell, the levels of risk that involve a pregnancy, I would place them into three different categories. There's a risk in every pregnancy, and we have a mitzvah to have children. Even there's an elevated risk involved, and then there's an unacceptable level of risk which we do not. Our ruling is you cannot continue the pregnancy because it's too dangerous for you. And then we have an intermediate level of risk, which is in some cases, if the woman does not want to continue, we can allow a termination. But if she wants to continue, she's allowed to continue. In that intermediate area, there are also basically two levels, in where although the risk is elevated, but there's no allowance to do an abortion. So I would think that this risk that you just mentioned about, it's a bit higher than a normal pregnancy because of the danger of infection or other reasons. It's still not enough to allow an abortion because it's manageable. It's manageable risk. Something which for cosmetic surgery, people do undertake these risks. So there's definitely not a reason to allow a termination. Yes.
What about abortion in the case of rape? Obviously, morning after pill is a solution, but if it didn't happen, so you're
It's a very difficult question because there are poskim that do allow it. Many poskim do not allow it because the child is doesn't have to suffer and they lose his life because the mother was raped. It's very difficult to allow an abortion for such a reason, but. No, we have to take into account other considerations too. In general, rape is not a reason enough to allow termination. Yes.
Can the rabbi comment on different fetal reasons?
Yeah, this is they're planning the next year. It's going to talk about fetal various fetal abnormalities which would allow or not allow terminations. That's it. Yeah. Shekai. So mentioned the next one will talk about fetal